Wow. I've been waiting a long time, actually, to speak about vocation. A long time, really. Not many people are waiting to speak on this topic, but I've been waiting a long time because a long time ago, when I was in eighth grade, that isn't when I started thinking about vocation, but I don't know what I was thinking about in eighth grade, but anyway, I went to a movie and we've been here before, but when I went to this movie, I saw this movie about New York City Police Department, and I knew, it's called Naming in poetry, the movie named me. My spirit resonated with the storyline and the characters, and I knew that that was my identity in some form or fashion. That's the beauty of art and poetry and literature, the power in it. And so I just made a kind of a commitment in that movie. It was very emotional for me. I was 14. I was in a movie that I wasn't supposed to be at because we weren't allowed to go to movies. So God works even in movies that you're not supposed to be in, apparently. It didn't seem to hinder him any, but I didn't really believe in God. So I was emotionally moved by it. And so because of my mom's Independent Baptist, and Independent Baptist, nothing counts unless you go forward. Doesn't matter how dramatic it is, unless you go forward, it doesn't count to God. Even if he is in the movie theater, if you don't go forward, it doesn't count. And so I went forward in the movie theater. I don't know why. I was over. I walked forward. I was the only one that went forward in the movie. And I actually turned around and made some kind of commitment to the projectionist, the only one to hold me accountable for that decision. And it was, what's funny is I never wavered. I never changed my mind from that. So went through high school, came to Christ when I was 17, which was interesting because it was the introduction of Jesus into my idea of being a police officer. It was like an identity coming into the idea of vocation. Long time ago. Wow. And so then I started to think, wow, what does it mean? I mean, I knew I wanted to be a police officer, but now what does it mean that I'm a believer? Can those go together? Do they go together? Does it make a difference? Am I a Christian police officer? Am I a police officer that happens to be a Christian? All these things. And then in the police department, you're not allowed to share your faith or talk about your religion. So do I separate my vocation from my identity in the kingdom? That doesn't seem right, but I don't want to get fired because I'm not a martyr. And so So is there a way to do that without getting fired? And so then I go into this journey, meet Donna in college, meet Donna, who wasn't a believer. She's Jewish. She comes to faith. It affects her Jewishness. And so all these things coming, and it allowed me to marry her, which is a good thing. And so then we get out of college and go into the police academy and come out of the police academy and get married and go into this profession, this vocation as a believer. And then, so I learned how to do that pretty well, actually. And basically what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to invite you to come tomorrow night, because tomorrow night I'm going to talk about what that actually means. How do you do that practically in any vocation? How does your identity impact and empower you in your vocation? I think you'll really enjoy this discussion tomorrow night. It's just so fascinating. Anyway, I figured out how my identity affected my vocation, and because it affected my vocation so dramatically, then the U.S. government came to me and said, "What is affecting your vocation so dramatically?" And I said, "My identity." And they said, "We don't know what that means. We're the government. We don't know everything," sort of thing. And so I explained to them, well, I'm a follower of Jesus, and, you know, it affects my policing in this way. And they're like, okay, that we don't, not only do we not know what you're talking about, we don't even like what you just said, but it works. So can you do whatever that is you just said in the Muslim world among militant Muslims? And I said I could, not because I knew I could, but because I wanted that job. And so I thought I could. How different can it be? Is really different, by the way. Oh, wow. Anyway, so So that opened up a whole new vocation to me, and it demanded that my identity be stronger and deeper, which I didn't actually know how to do. So off we went into the Muslim world for the next 25 years. And in that whole experience of that time, and even with the events of that we've just experienced in Europe and Lebanon, that's our world that we work in, is that world. And how does my identity in the kingdom affect my vocation in that world? Last year we were in Paris, and we were there working on a specific project related to Islam in France, called by the U.S. government to be there, and by the U.S. embassy officials called us in because they knew what we were working on, and they wanted to know what we would do in the situation of Islamic extremism in France. They asked us, they invited us and asked us, because they wanted to know how we were so effective in our vocation. And it was because of our identity. And I explained it to them. And they just couldn't quite grasp it. Like, we don't get that. Because we don't have an identity ourselves. That was their problem. They were operating in a vocation with no identity. And so, as a result, they couldn't enact what we were suggesting they do. And so, here we are. Here we are. We'll talk about that tomorrow night, more about what that looked like. So tonight I'm frustrated because of the situation. And I'm frustrated because if we understood identity and vocation from the Bible, actually, this world would look completely different than it does right now. And so when I knew you guys were doing this series, and John Mark with his book, Garden City, which is a great book, and this started, and Gerald called me, and I listened to the first couple of weeks and the panel discussion, and they asked if I would jump in at this point. I was so happy to do it because I want to talk about this topic. So tonight, all I want to do is just introduce the idea from the Bible. And then tomorrow night, just do some discussion and Q&A. Talk about practically what does it mean to have an identity, to put that identity inside a vocation that reflects that identity and move it out into the world. It's unbelievable what you can accomplish. I'm just going to show you a picture of it right now from the scripture. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read from the book of Daniel, chapter 1. I was planning on doing this before, a month ago, I was thinking about this. We've been speaking on this a little bit in different places, not quite so directly as we're going to do it tonight. And this is the passage I wanted to do. And listen how appropriate this passage is. So look at your, whatever you have, book, iPad, whatever you have, look at that, your hand, whatever. And this is the book of Daniel. Listen how appropriate this is to today. Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, interesting, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now listen to verse 2. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into the hand of the bad guy. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar with some of the vessels of the house of God. So they actually took stuff from the house of God. And he, Nebuchadnezzar, brought them, the king of Babylon, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. What, like, what is that? What is happening there? Here's the Judah, who was given their identity by God. Given their identity by God, and somehow they've come so far out of that identity that God just gives up on them and hands them over to the bad guy, to the Babylonians. Like, how did that happen? Can we have an identity that's of God that we just lose, or worse, never even know? What happens? This is what I said to our government last year. If you bring a high identity militant religion into a culture of agnostic no identity, they can't stop it. The evil will just run right over top of it because there's no identity to stand against the evil identity. There's nothing there. It just sweeps in, and my progressive agnosticism that doesn't believe in anything can't withstand it. There is no identity to withstand this evil identity. There's nothing there. What stands against an evil identity is a true identity. That's what beats it. Not a no identity. Not a, I don't know who we are. I don't know what I do. I just walk around and think about stuff. And then here comes this high identity murderer that just runs you down. Well, listen, this is how Isaiah describes Israel before they go down the drain. Here's how he describes them. This is Isaiah chapter 1. He says, they were, Israel, a sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel into anger. They are gone away backward. They're actually going backward, which we'll really talk about tomorrow night intellectually. You go backward. It's really fascinating. It says, you will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. The whole heart is faint. There's no courage there. It's faint. From the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores that have not been clothed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. You are sick. That's how he describes a country, Israel. Israel, whose identity is the nation selected by God, the called out ones, the priests, the holy nation. This is how they're being described in the identity that they've taken on in place of that amazing identity. This identity is an identity of sick and wounded people who are faint of heart and are basically afraid of everything in the world. Now, I know myself, and there's times in my life where that's a description of me. Like bound up with anxiety and fear and pain, and I can't think straight through problems. And my reasoning doesn't move me forward. It actually takes me backward. As hard as I try, as hard as I work, because I have no identity. I don't know what I'm standing for. And then what's my vocation without an identity? What do? I could do this or that. It doesn't really matter. Do you love your job? No. Why? Because I just do it. Why? I have to pay bills. Is that an existence? Is that the best we can hope for? This? Because when you live like this, you are open game for the enemy. He will roll over you. He will capture you, and off you go into captivity. And what happens in this situation is that Israel, that's supposed to be the nation to liberate nations, that's supposed to go out and conquer the world for God, gets conquered by the world. You know, when God created Adam and Eve in the garden, he said, rule and reign, rule and reign. That's what you're supposed to be doing. But that's not what we're doing. We're not ruling the world. The world is ruling us. Do you know how we know that's true? We're afraid. We're afraid. We're scared. We're not rulers. We're fearful people, and we're faint of heart, and we're afraid it's going to come here and get us. What kind of vocation do you have in that mentality? But here's what's fascinating about this situation. And I know this is who's in this room tonight, is what this passage goes on to talk about. So they're taken captive. It's a captive situation. And so then the king of the bad guys, the Babylonians, verse 3, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. So the king, he selects out these people from the other group, from the victims, from the people without an identity. He selects out certain ones of them that are from noble families and they're well educated and they're good looking and all this stuff of royal, of nobility, of royal priestly families, royalty families. And they select them out and they're going to teach them, they're going to give them an identity. They're going to give them the identity of the enemy. That's always the strategy of the enemy, is to come at you because your identity is either weak or non-existent. This is what Satan does to Eve in the garden. And he attacks that identity, and we give it up in exchange for his identity. He gives us the identity. Remember when God said to Adam and Eve, he said to Adam, go around, because you're the ruler, you guys are ruling and reigning, go around and name things. You name things. You're the one. I gave you a name, now you name things. You're a creator. You're an image bearer. Rule, name. And now what happens, though, is they fall. They doubt God. They don't trust him. They think he's holding back on them. And so they fall, and now Satan names them. They give up the right to name, and they become named by everyone around them. Who gives you the name you go by? I mean the name down here, the one you don't like. Who gave you that name? People, teachers, employers, people that don't like you, someone that just gets mad at you in traffic and yells at you, and that name sticks, that identity sticks. Those names, unworthy, drug addict, alcoholic, terrible worker, all those names, those identities, and we just receive them. You know why? Because we don't have an identity. But so this is what the enemy does. He comes in, he takes captives, he brings the best of those captives, the potentially dangerous ones, he brings them out, and he educates them in the way he thinks and gives them his names. That's what Satan does. And when he has us in that position, we die. We perish. But, there were these four guys in that group. It's interesting, these four. So the idea is to bring these people in, separate them from their Jewish identity, and fill them with Babylonian identity. That's the goal. It's always Satan's goal. Separate you from your true identity and fill you with a false identity that he owns you from then on. And all you can think is his thoughts. The only way you can look at the world is with fear, guilt, and shame, because that's how he talks. That's only what you can see. And so every event in the world is terrifying and horrifying, and it's coming to get me. But there's these four guys. And these four men, these four young men, they're teenagers, if you can imagine that. They're teenagers. What kind of parents did they have? These four teenagers have an identity that they own. And no matter where they are, their identity doesn't change. Nothing changes their identity. Their identity is from God. And it says their names. It's funny because out of all the great people that the Babylonians bring in, these are good families, these are noble people, they're well-educated, brings them in, only four are ever mentioned. You know why? Because the other ones don't make it. The other ones don't make it. These guys make it. Why? Listen carefully. Because they bring their identity into a situation. They don't get their identity from a situation. Do you know how much power you have when you live like that? No matter what someone says to me, it doesn't change my identity from God. That makes me powerful. That makes them powerless. These guys don't see themselves as captives. They don't get it. You're a captive. No, we're not. No, you are. Look at the facts. I know. We're not captives. You, where are your parents? Either, I don't know. Well, did you come here because you wanted to? Nope. That's a captive. Oh, you don't accept that. Don't those kind of, those people drive you crazy. It's like, aren't you afraid? No. Are we supposed to be afraid? No, we're not. Well, who do you think you are? Well, here's what Daniel's name means. Daniel's name means God is my judge. Who's Daniel concerned about judging him? Not the Babylonians. He doesn't care about them. He's concerned about what God thinks, because God is my judge, not you. And if you're not my judge, you don't owe me, so. Wouldn't that be a great way to live? Wouldn't you love to go in a vocation where you don't get your identity from the vocation? You bring your identity into the vocation and own it and rule it and have the most amazing ideas in that vocation that anyone's ever had? Because you know how to bring your identity and mix it into the vocation, which is what we're going to talk about tomorrow, how to do that. Hananiah's name means Jehovah is gracious. What kind of name is that? You're a captive. No, I'm Jehovah is gracious. You call Jehovah gracious in this situation? Yes. Because he was gracious before this situation, and he'll be gracious in this situation, and he'll be gracious at the end of this situation. It doesn't matter what you do. Wow. That person, you can't beat that person. You can't scare that person. Mishael means, who is he that is God? Or who is what God is? Who can be what God is? That's his name. And so the Babylonians are like, do you know who we are? Do you know who God is? That's his name. Every time they call him, hey, do you know who what God is? That's what they're saying. Hey, God judges us. Wait, no. So Azariah's name means the Lord helps. You're in big trouble. The Lord helps. Do you see their falseness falls down when it hits the identity of these men? You know who? I would love to meet their parents. What kind of parent? What were their parents like? Listen, if you're ever taken captive, I wouldn't worry about it. We're going to name you this so you won't worry about it in case captivity ever comes around. Because looking around the way our nation's going, we think it's probably just around the corner. So we're going to give you a name that's sort of anti-captivity name. Don't forget your identity when you're in captivity. Remember that? The Lord helps? Yes. Isn't that beautiful? So what does the enemy have to do? Change their names. The enemy has to change that identity. So I call this satanic identity theft. So what the enemy is going to come in and do is take away their identity by changing their names. Changing the name that God calls you. So the enemy is going to give you a new name. Instead of those God is gracious and all that stuff, forget that stuff. So they get new names. It's fascinating when you look through their new names, which I have here somewhere. So Daniel, his new name, Belteshazzar, means may Baal protect my life, the false god. That's his new name. Baal's the god of Babylon. Taking his real identity and changing it to your life depends on a false god, and you better be afraid. Who does your life depend on? You want to know who you think your life depends on? Who are you afraid of? That's who you think your life depends on. What are you afraid of? You're afraid of not having enough money? You're afraid that some country's going to come get you? Then that's your god. Then that's who you think protects you, is them? That's wrong. And that'll kill your life. You will never live. Even if it never happens, you think it will. You live like it will. That's called faith. Faith in a false situation. Wow. Hananiah is given the name Shadrach, which means the command of Aku, or commanded by Aku, the moon god. What a switch. Mishael is Meshach, which means who is what the moon god is. See, it's exchanging the glory of God for the created thing, and you die. You die when you get your identity from anything other than God. Azariah is given the name Abednego, which means the servant of Nebo, the god, the Babylonian god. So the strategy of the enemy is to come in, take you captive because you have no sense of identity, and then cause you to live in a false identity. If you're a person that has a sense of identity, enemy strategy is to come in and to get you to exchange your true identity for a false identity based on the circumstances around you. So we get up, we watch the news, and we make a determination about how safe we are, not by whether God's on the throne. What's going on in the news? That's your God. That's your God. That's who judges your day. That's who determines your future. Not him. And it's a terrible life. It's a terrible life. You can't do anything really risky in that kind of world. So these guys, so the next thing the enemy wants to do is indoctrinate you in the way he sees the world so that you live by his view of the world, which is that it's all bad. And you better do everything you can to protect yourself because it's bad. Protect your kids. Make sure your kids don't go anywhere unsafe, which is a difficult environment to learn faith in, by the way. No, you don't need faith. Just do what I tell you to do and go here and don't go there like that. But these guys, they refuse to give up their identity. Like, you can call me what you want, but I know in my heart, God is my judge and he is gracious. And you don't even know who he is. And so they're super respectful. And it's almost like they're talking together and saying, how long do you think it's, you know, they get together, the four of them. And it's like, how long do you, let's see, we're like 17 now. How long do you think before we run this whole country? That's how they see it. I don't know, it's probably going to take at least 3 years. Listen, we think that's dumb, don't we? Because we don't have the identity that they do. We should. They're like, we're not going to die here. Let's just take over the place. How? Well, let's become so good in our vocation that we're better than any of their people. How? By maintaining our identity inside of our vocation. Brilliant. Brilliant. So, let's figure out what they want from us. So it says, the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years. At the end of that time, they were to stand before the king, and it gives their names, and the chief of the eunuchs gave them the other names. But Daniel, look what he does, verse 8, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. What's David doing? He's not trying to be mean or like, I refuse to eat. It's not that. What he's saying is I'm going to keep my identity separate. I'm going to maintain my identity in any way I can. You can call me any name you want, but I'm going to maintain my identity here. How? In any way that I can. This is a brilliant strategy for survival, actually, through torture and all kinds of things, is to maintain little parts of your identity no matter what. People that maintain their identity in torture, I'll tell you about this tomorrow, never give up, because their identity is too strong. You can't kill their identity. You can't beat it out of. If there's no identity, they die, because there's nothing to stand for, nothing to live for. So they're building a territory of where can we stand firm in our identity and negotiate and navigate the situation. So strategic, so brilliant. Who taught them this stuff? How do they know this stuff? And so that's one place. Let's see if we can stand our ground here. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself, his identity. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the bad guys. God gave Daniel and his friends favor in the sight of the enemy. Why? Because God is not afraid of the bad guys. He owns the bad guys. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I'm afraid that the king who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, he drops down another level of negotiation with a lower level bureaucrat. Then Daniel said to the steward, brilliant strategy, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, he says, verse 12, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he's just saying, well, let's just try this out. This is because he knows that if he maintains his identity before the king will honor him. God will honor him. God will defend him. He's not afraid of that. And he can tell because the eunuch and the steward are already starting, they like him. They're like, these guys are different, man. Where are all the other Israeli young people that were taken? They're gone, they're done, they're already out. They didn't maintain their identity. You can't even talk about them. They're just like nobody. But not these four guys. And it builds respect among the enemy. That's a pretty fascinating strategy. And so he says, test us. And so at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in the flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So we could do a whole thing on that little statement. 17. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill. Listen, in all the literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams of the Chaldean literature, of the Chaldean culture. Do you know who did this before Daniel and his buddies did it? Moses did it. Moses did it with the Egyptians. I wonder if they know that story. Who taught Moses how to make Israel a nation to be set free? The enemy. The enemy trained Moses how to liberate the slaves. God's not afraid of the enemy. Why are we? Because we don't have an identity under God. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, their real names, by the way. Therefore, they stood before the king, and in every manner of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of the king Cyrus, and Daniel and his friends ruled the situation. They ruled it. They were 20 when this happened. 20. Is this real stuff? Is this like real life? We have been studying for years, working in very difficult, bad situations. Can we go inside of a militant, hostile organization and maintain our identity in such a way inside of our vocation that we actually own the enemy in a matter of time? And we've learned how to do it. You know where we learned how to do it? Right there. I'll give you one example, and then tomorrow we'll go way into it. It's so fascinating. And finally, I can explain what we've been doing. Here's where we first tried this. Long 1990, we went to work for the government of Indonesia. And we went to work in a small island on a university working for the Ministry of Education of the government of Indonesia. So we were inside the government, inside the system, like these guys. And we went inside the system and we taught in a predominantly Islamic university. On the island where we were, there was a militant movement growing on the east side of the island, and 300 Saudi missionaries there to work it. This is in 1990. Our team had six people, so 300, well-funded, and six with kids. Our team had kids, which wasn't a huge help at the time. Anyway, so we go to work inside the university, 98% Muslim university, all the staff, all the leadership of the university, Islamic. What are you going to do? And so we're asking God, what's the strategy inside this system to bring spiritual transformation? So we're inside, we're vastly outnumbered. We don't have guns, we're military, it's just us. And so we ask God, what's the strategy? And because we follow a God who speaks and a God who names us, and we know our identities really well. Our team knows our identities really well. And we only work inside of our own identities because it's the only place we have full power. And we're very professional in our resumes, and that's why we were hired there, because when they check our professional skills, we're really good at what we do. And so the university says to us, can you come up with, in our university of 10,000, 20 students? We'll take one of them, any one of them. If they get a Fulbright scholarship to a foreign university, we will thank God the day you came, because we've never had that happen in the history of our university. But you have to teach them the way we tell you to teach, and it cannot be Christian or biblical, nothing like that. It's like this, and we're like, oh, this is the book of Daniel. We know exactly what to do here. And they already eat vegetables, so that's not the problem. That's what they do. They don't drink. We already got the diet down. We don't have to ask for that. So we prayed and we said, Lord, is this the strategy inside of our identities? We're not going to give up our identity of who we are to win this contract. That would be the worst thing we could do. We're not going to be afraid. No, no. Yeah, we're going to only teach what you say so that you won't put us in jail or worse to us. So we're only going to do what you say. We're going to sacrifice our identities to try and make this thing work. You're already done. It's already over. You finished. You've lost. So we prayed, went to the head of the university, and I said, can we do an experiment? Like, I just thought of this, you know, kind of thing. And he's like, what? And I said, can you give us 3 months, with 20 students that we select and and leave us completely alone. Don't bother us. Don't photocopy what we do. Don't put informants among our group. Promise us, just give us 20 Muslim students, grad students, and leave us completely alone for 3 months. And I promise you that you'll have more Fulbright scholars come out of this group than you've had in the history of your university, which was only two, but sounded awesome, you know, like... But really, 2 and 3 months to be tested by Fulbright to come in and test them, to get full scholarships. I promise you this will happen. He's like, and I said, if it doesn't work, we'll teach any way you want for free. He's like, wow, okay, we take that. So we went in there. We picked the 20 students, Muslim men and women grad students. We picked the 20. And the very first day that we had them, I used Stephen Krashen, linguist, theory of affective filter. I took that theory and I mixed it with the Spirit of God. So we're going to talk about inside of my identity, because I have a degree in this. And I mixed that theory with my understanding of Scripture and the influence of the Holy Spirit, and we came up with a new curriculum of how to teach language. And at the end of the time, Fulbright from the U.S. came in and tested all 20 of our students, and 16 of them got full scholarships. Yeah. Yeah, and the Fulbright guys pulled me aside, and they said, how did you get the test? They thought we cheated. like, look where we are. How would we get your test out here? And he goes, I know, that's what I thought, but how do, they're so good. Our students used English vocabulary that the American testers didn't know. I'm not kidding. I'll tell you about it tomorrow. At the end of the testing and everything, like, we're going to take 14 of these students, full ride. We're taking them out. And the university came to us like, you do whatever you want. You want it, you do. And all of the guys that would love to have seen us dead were silenced because the head of that university looked like the smartest person in the world. Fulbright called me and said, will you run all Fulbright operations in eastern Indonesia? We want you. We've never seen anyone that can do, like, the team that can do this. Can you do it? And so in our vocation, in our profession, because of our identity in the kingdom, we went like this. And we owned that place. We owned it in 3 months. In this, can you imagine what you guys can do in the world if you understood that? You in this room, if you knew your identity in the kingdom, which is the number one thing you must know, and then from that identity, it fits naturally and beautifully into a vocation, and you will bring into that vocation, which you will love, ways of thinking that haven't been thought of yet. Here's the first step to all of that. Say yes to God. I had this picture before I came in of, like, being handcuffed, and just God said, just show them how to do this with the handcuffs that handcuff them. Psh, break it. Whatever's locking you down in your life, come up here and be finished with it by saying yes to God. He'll take care of that part of it. Say yes to him, get your identity, move into a vocation that you will love, and go out into the world. And I'm telling you, the terrorism will run from you. It will run from you. But if we sit here and hide, they'll come get us. Don't do that. Don't do that. Father, I pray for these folks.